Right, excuse me, brethren, good afternoon. Let's get underway. You'll recollect, I'm sure, if you've been with us the last few weeks, that we've been talking very much about the subject of prophecy and asking, in a sense, when rightly understood, do the prophecies of the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, do they point more to, let's say, Islam, the Islamic realm, than perhaps they do to Rome and to Europe, which is probably the latter being our traditional background, looking for 10 nations in Europe to combine together to work closely in association with perhaps the Roman Catholic Church to bring in the end time tribulation and so on. But is that the most plausible explanation? Or might Islam be a better candidate? And what we've said a number of times now is what's particularly important for you and me is to be very familiar with the narrative of Scripture, the text. What does the text say? And we should know that. I mean, that's really more or less beyond dispute. We can read it. And sometimes the narrative itself, the text, tells us very clearly what various prophetic symbols are. Of course, often it doesn't, and then we start moving towards our own understanding and sometimes towards, you know, well-meaning speculation. For example, it's very clear in Daniel chapter 8, if you recollect Daniel chapter 8, there is a ram and a he-goat, and the scriptures tell us the ram is Persia, or today, Iran, or for Americans, Iran. And you can't argue that, it tells you. So that's very helpful. In Daniel chapter 2, we have the famous statue of gold, silver, bronze, and so on. And in the prophecy itself, it says that the head of gold is Babylon, the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day. Again, that's in the narrative. We can see that. However, there is much information where it's not explicitly stated. For example, and we spent some time on this, in Daniel chapter 2, on this famous statue, when we get to the legs of iron, the toes of iron and clay, in other words, the fourth empire, what is it? Is it Rome and Europe? Is it the Islamic Empire? It doesn't say explicitly, so we have to try and work from the scriptures and hopefully be responsible in the way that we interpret scripture. Or when we turn to Daniel chapter 7, which we'll do later today, there's a famous fourth beast, great and terrible, with teeth of iron. It doesn't tell us explicitly what empire that is. So obviously everybody endeavors to interpret what the scriptures might mean. And of course, I think we should be humble enough to say that we cannot be dogmatic. We can try to be responsible students of prophecy, not speculate wildly, not fantasize, but we can't be always entirely dogmatic. And I think most of us, as I said a moment ago, are quite familiar from our many years around the church, and even if you came from some other churches, with the concept that the prophecies relate to a 10-nation combine in Europe, probably led politically by Germany, but working closely in association with the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church. Well, okay, that may be the case. I'm not being dogmatic. But, you know, when you look at Europe today, it doesn't look that way. It's got lots of economic problems. It's really quite reluctant to engage in any type of active warfare. It's not aggressive spiritually as a continent. Western Europe is really quite secular. It's not spiritually strong, and that could change, of course. That's why I leave the door open, although it's hard to see really how it could significantly change. But on the other hand, if we look at the Islamic realm, the Islamic religion, you know, that religion of peace, as it's often referred to, which is complete, abject, utter nonsense. It's got a 1,400-year history of violence. That's now stirring up after perhaps a few decades of being at rest. And today, if you look at the Middle East, anywhere in the Middle East, and even with some inroads into to Europe and North America, the Islamic realm is full of tension and violence. You know, think of ISIS. Think of the jihadist attacks in Paris in November. Think of the 270 million approximately who have been killed in the name of jihad over the past 1400 years. And there's certainly much more happening in the Islamic world. There's more danger. There's more hostility. There's more religious violence. There are more so-called martyrs. There are more ingredients of end-time prophecy than seems to be the case in Europe. So definitely, I believe, worth keeping our eyes on what's happening in the Islamic world. But it's not only a case of, you know, seeing what's happening out there on our TV screens or on our internet news. There's also biblical reasons for considering Islam to be the subject of prophecy. Again, you may remember in Daniel 2, chapter 40, chapter 2, verse 40, this statue, remember, the iron legs? It says this fourth empire would crush and break in pieces or pulverize all the others. Did Rome do that? We said no, it didn't. Rome doesn't qualify. Does Islam qualify? Yep. The Empire of Islam certainly crushed, pulverized, and destroyed repeatedly. In Daniel chapter 8, we have the Ram and the He-Goat. Is that Islamic? Well, it tells us. One is Iran, and the He-Goat is Javan, which is probably modern-day Turkey, which is Islamic. So two Islamic nations identified explicitly in Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel 9, verses 26 and 27, we had the seven-year covenant, which a particular prince, please discuss, stops at the halfway point and erects an abomination of desolation. Well, that could be the Messiah confirming his covenant for two three-and-a-half-year periods, but I give you reasons why I don't think that's really strong. The other alternative is that it's the prince who is to come, the Antichrist, and it says that he comes from the people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary. And although General Titus, a Roman, was in charge, the actual guys who destroyed the sanctuary and the temple in 70 AD were from Syria and Egypt, today's Islamic nations. So, you know, as you look at scripture with, I think, an open mind, Islam just seems to pop up as an extremely plausible alternative. Without making a big point of it, in Daniel 2:43, talking of the feet of the statue, it says the toes and so on were of a mixture of iron and clay. It says the people shall be mixed at that time. People shall be mingled. Well, in Hebrew, that is, the people shall be Arab. Well, the people shall be Arab? Well, of course, the Arab world is Islamic. Now, that might just be one of those curious coincidences, but in the Hebrew, the people shall be Arab. Then, of course, let's not forget Revelation 20, verse 4, where it talks of those who have been beheaded for the word of God and their testimony. Well, which religion or governments have always favored beheading from the get-go? The answer is Islam. even just last Monday, a week ago, Saudi Arabia beheaded its 56th criminal, I suppose they'd say, of the year. And Saudi Arabia, by the way, let's not forget, is the home to the city of Mecca, which is the holiest city in Islam, to which all devout Muslims pray, pointing towards Mecca in Saudi Arabia 5 times a day. And the strongest nation for beheading is the nation where the holy city of Mecca is to be found. So, you know, you could go on and on. But let's open our scriptures now and move on a wee bit to Daniel chapter 7, which we did some of this last week, but a bit of a recap. And maybe you did it the week before, but it's easy to forget. It's important to remind ourselves of what we've studied. I mean, I think people have said that most folk tend to forget most of what they hear within 24 hours. And what's left tends to disappear after a week. So for most of us, you know, unless you're an exception, we forget things rather rapidly. Okay. But let's pick up the story in Daniel 7 about the four beasts. And it's important, in a sense, to understand as much as we can of the four beasts, because the four beasts of Daniel help us to understand Revelation 13 and its beasts. And we'll get there a bit later today. Famous last words. And so Revelation, Daniel 7, verses 3 to 8. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion. Verse 5, and suddenly another beast, the second, like a bear. Verse 6, a third beast, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So we've got a beast like a lion, that's important. A beast like a bear, that's important. A beast like a leopard with four heads. So if you're counting heads, that's now six. And then, of course, verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, notice that expression, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So we got four beasts with a total of 7 heads, because there's one for the lion, one for the bear, one for the fourth beast, and then 4 heads on the leopard. So 7 heads, and the fourth beast also has 10 horns. And this is a great and terrible beast. Now, I think if you look at those words there, it broke in pieces, trampled the residue. That does sound a wee bit like what we spent a lot of time on about Rome didn't really do that. So whilst traditionally it's popular to see this great terrible beast as the Roman Empire, there are some weaknesses there, because that's not really what Rome did. It did conquer. Well, it never conquered Persia. It never conquered the bear, if you like, at any point. And traditionally, and I think it's probably fair to say that most people agree, the lion of verse 4, the first beast is Babylon, at least in terms of identifying who it is. The second beast, the bear, is understood to be Persia, or modern-day Iran. So Babylon is today's Iraq. Let's bring it up to today. Babylon is today's Iraq. The bear is today's Iran. The leopard is typically understood to be Javan, usually translated in Greece, but more likely to be modern-day Turkey and that region. And I think most folk are going to go with those explanations. Now, the fourth beast, yep, is it Rome? That's popular. Does it really work? I've given you reasons why I think not, and why it's almost certainly going to be the Islamic Empire pictured in that verse. Then verse 8, I was considering the horns, these 10 horns, which would represent 10 kings or kingdoms, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of their first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words, an arrogant individual, strong and powerful because he's referred to as a horn. So there are 10 kings, 10 kings, and one comes up, it says, after them, who is arrogant. Probably, I'll suggest, either, if you go with the Roman view, this is said to be the papacy. If you go with the Islamic view, this would be perhaps the Islamic Antichrist, the one who rules the other 10 Islamic nations at the end. Okay, so those are certainly two options. I think one is much more plausible than the other, I've got to say. Dropping down to verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which this little horn was speaking. I watched till the beast, the fourth beast, was slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So it ends in disaster for this fourth beast at the arrival of the Lord Jesus. Verses 17 and 18, or verse 14, sorry, verse 14. Then two, the Ancient of Days, Jesus, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion, the Lord Jesus, is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. His kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed, as of course the others all were. So the whole story, the four beasts, takes us right up to Christ's return and the millennial kingdom at the end of the age. So it's the whole story. Look at verses 17 and 18. Those great beasts, lion, bear, leopard, the terrible one, are four kings which arise out of the earth, but we took some time to say that's in the future tense, and many, many, many translations say four kings which shall arise out of the earth. That's four kings in the future. And the relevance there is that when Daniel received this prophecy, the Lion Empire was almost finished. Babylon was on its last king. It didn't last much longer. So if you're talking of four beasts which are yet future to arise, then it's not talking about the historic empire of Babylon, and probably not either Persia or Greece/Turkey. That helps us identify them, but the prophetic reference is, let's say, like the rest of Daniel, the far-off and distant future, hopefully, in a sense, our time today. Verse 18 tells us, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So the whole story takes us right down to Christ's return and the millennium. Okay, let's look at Daniel 7, verses 19 to 22, because Daniel's curious. He gets the lion and the leopard and so on, but he says, I wanted to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, about the other horn which came up before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn, this little horn, although it grew up to be quite big eventually, this little horn was making war against the saints, and not only making war, but prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favour of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So this little horn makes war against those who, I think, carried the name of Christ, and prevails right up to Jesus' return. That's where it says. So that's the one that Daniel's really, you know, curious about. What is this all about? What does this mean? And thankfully, the angel gives him an explanation. Notice verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast, the one we're all curious about, shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. So is there anything there we can use to try and identify, is this Rome? Is it something else? Well, it says it's different. That's a clue, because really, was Rome, the Roman Empire, that different from the Greek Empire, from the Persian Empire? Be hard to say. They all did much the same stuff. They warred over territory. They established their rule. They took taxes. You wouldn't say Rome, I wouldn't think, would be hugely different from the Greek Empire. In fact, you know, Rome quite liked much of Greek culture and religion and philosophy, and so they tended to actually accept a lot of Greek ideas. The Greek language was still a very common language throughout the Roman Empire. So is Rome very different? Don't think so. Is Islam very different? Absolutely. Because here's a religion which goes out attacking in the name of Allah and capturing territory across North Africa, across the Middle East, right across Europe up into Spain and France over many centuries, all done in the name of a god. The Islamic Empire is quite different from those before it. Notice also it says it tramples and breaks in pieces. Did Rome do that? No, we covered that endlessly. But notice also it says here, it shall devour the whole earth. Now, I guess the question there is, does it mean the whole globe from Alaska to South America, through India into Japan, through China, through the Russia, all the way down through the Middle East and across Europe? Does it mean the whole world? Or is it potentially somewhat more limited territory? And one way to look at it is, it says here, verse 23, shall devour the whole earth. The Hebrew for whole earth there is there two words, kol, K-O-L, and ara, A-R-A. That's obviously the English letters, kol, K-O-L, ara, A-R-A. That's the whole earth. Does that expression appear anywhere else in the book of Daniel? Yeah, thankfully it does. So let's turn to Daniel chapter 2, verses 37 to 39. Daniel chapter 2 and verses 37 to 39, which gives us a clue, I think a fairly strong clue as to how we should interpret the expression whole earth. This fourth beast, this great terrible beast, devours and tramples across the whole earth. What should we look for in the end times? Well, picking up in verse 37, Daniel's just explaining the vision or the dream of this great statue to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand, has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So, question, was Nebuchadnezzar in charge of the people of Alaska, of Central and South America, of Tibet, etc.? The answer is obviously not. But it says here, verse 38, wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the air, you're in charge. The answer, of course, is no. Clearly, we can understand that as being in your realm, Nebuchadnezzar, in your territory, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the boss man. Now notice verse 39. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. Call Ara. Same expression. And so the third empire, the one that is translated typically as Greece, or perhaps Asia Minor, it says it will rule over all the earth. Well, did it rule over Africa? Did it rule over Russia? Did it rule over, you know, the Red Indians of North America? Did it rule over people in Japan? No. So we can't just jump from the expression whole earth or all the earth to necessarily conclude it must mean all 7 billion people on the earth. Because as used by Daniel, in the book of Daniel, clearly it can have, and in fact did have, if you like, a territorial limitation. It applied to the territory which Greece or Asia Minor ruled, the territory that Babylon or Nebuchadnezzar ruled. Excuse me. So we have the same prophet using the same identical expression. I suppose, would you ask, well, could it mean the entire globe of 7 billion people, of all, you know, 200 nations on the earth? In terms of the end time fulfillment, well, it could, I suppose. Can't be dogmatic. But at the same time, it's probably most likely, if we take it in context, that it's referring to the earth, the territory within the prophecy, which is the Islamic realm, which would be Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Egypt, Libya, Sudan, Afghanistan, and so on. So when you get this end time wars, and this fourth beast is trampling the residue, breaking in pieces, creating absolute mayhem across its chosen territory, that probably, I'm going to suggest, is limited. It might be a big area, but it's be a big area centered around the Middle East. Of course, it would have massive knock-on effects in the rest of the world, because this is where the oil comes from, you know, the Persian Gulf. So anything causing, you know, mayhem across the oil fields of the Middle East, the knock-on effect in terms of economics, share values, uncertainty, perhaps stirring up jihadists in other territories to get in reaction. Yeah, I think there'll be major secondary problems, but I think the main thrust of the prophecy directly is within the Islamic territory. There's possible corroboration of this. If we turn to Revelation chapter 6, read verses 7 and 8. So I'm not being dogmatic here. The term all the earth, the whole earth, could potentially mean all of it. But the way it's used, actually, in the scripture, it's talking of the, if you like, the territory that is within the remit of the prophecy. Going beyond that, we're probably speculating a little bit, maybe rightly, but it's a step we can't, I think, just take for granted. So does Revelation 6, verses 7 and 8, perhaps corroborate a more limited region for these end time events? I think it's hinted at. I'm not going to say this is, you know, again, something we can be dogmatic about. But in Revelation 6, you've got the four horsemen of the apocalypse and the six seals being opened. So we're going to jump down and pick up the fourth seal, verses 7 and 8. If we're right in looking at the Islamic Empire for the fulfillment of Daniel 2 and 7 and 8 and 9, and that's sort of what we're, I guess, strongly suggesting, then we've got to assume that the seals of Revelation 6 are probably going to have a very much an Islamic flavor to their fulfillment. But let's jump in anyway. We'll get to that another time probably, but in Revelation 6, 7 and 8, when Jesus opened the fourth seal, I heard a voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by beasts of the earth. So a couple of things to bring out there. It's a pale horse, and then it refers to this horse having power or authority over one-fourth of the earth. Now, I used to read this, and in fact, I think I've got a marginal reference somewhere talking about how one-quarter of the earth's population will die. It actually doesn't say that. That was me jumping to conclusions some time ago, I guess. It says power over one-fourth to kill. It doesn't say kills one-fourth. So the implication, well, the statement is authority of one quarter of the earth in which it can kill some or many. But it's not saying it kills one quarter of all the earth. It is power over a quarter of the earth in which it's free to kill with the sword, hunger, death, etc. But we'll get back to that in a moment. I just want to stop with the reference to the pale horse because it's intriguing, this. No proof here. This is just one of those interesting little sort of things. You think, I wonder.
Ring your bell, Mr. Coulter.
Yeah, for a cowbell, and Mr. Coulter would probably ring it here, because pale horse is from the Greek chloros. You spell that chloros, chloros, a bit like say chlorophyll, and it means green. So it's a green horse. It's curious, in passing, that the colour of Islam is green. But you knew that. But the colour of Islam is green. Why is it green? Well, a number of reasons. Mohammed's favourite colour was green. And obviously, if you're a Muslim, you're a follower, in theory at least, of Mohammed. When I was growing up, typically people referred to him as Mohammedans. And, of course, his favourite colour was green. He wore, apparently, a green cloak and a green turban. At one point in time, only important Muslims were allowed to wear green turbans because, Mohammed wore one, and your common Muslim wouldn't be permitted to wear a green turban, but your sort of elite, could. Mohammed's writings are full of references to green. There is a passage in the Quran that says that when you get to paradise, if you go there, people will wear green garments of fine silk. When Muhammad died, he was covered with a green square garment. And green is a very popular colour across the Arab Islamic world today. It's very popular, for example, for the covers, the bindings of the Quran itself. Green. So,
if you've got a green horse,
maybe this reference to a green horse is just coincidence that it's the colour of Islam. It could well be, but it's curious. Why a green horse? Why Islam? And then I asked the question, why is it translated as a pale horse in my Bible? Because it says here, I look and behold a pale horse. Well, the word's green. I don't really get this entirely, and I'll prove that, because if you look at Revelation 8:7, so just a few lines away, Revelation 8:7, which, by the way, is written by the same person who wrote, Revelation 6, the Apostle John. It says, the first angel sounded his trumpet, on hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Green grass. Same word, chloros. It's not pale grass. It's green grass. So that's the word chloros, that's the word green, and it's pretty obvious what it means. Look at Revelation 9:4. By the way, same writer, same apostle, same book, Revelation 9, chapter 4, but unto the fifth trumpet, and we read here, they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing, that would be vegetation, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So green thing or green vegetation, green, chloros, chloros, green, green thing, green grass. Hold your place here in Revelation 6, but turn back to Mark 6. Mark 6, and read verses 37 to 40. So Mark chapter 6, verses 37 to 40. There's one of the feeding of 5,000 about to take place, but we'll pick up just before that in verse 37 of Mark 6. Jesus answered and said to them, you give them something to eat. And the disciples said, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat? He said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass, the chloros grass. So they sat down in ranks in hundreds and in fifties. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Green, green grass, green vegetation, green grass. The word chloros only appears 4 times in the New Testament.
And it means green.
3 times in the book of Revelation. It's translated green 3 of the 4 times. Why on earth wouldn't you translate it in Revelation 6 as green? It's a green horse, not a pale horse. A few translations have got pale green horse. They can't seem to leave the word pale. Interestingly, when I went back to the first English translation of the Bible from the original Greek, that's William Tyndale's translation, which he translated from the Greek. First time it ever happened. There'd been one English translation 100 and something years earlier, but that was from the Latin. So William Tyndale was the first translator. In fact, if you read the King James Version and compare that to the Tyndale Version from 1525, it's very, very similar, not identical. And if you look at Mr. Tyndale's translation of Revelation 6, it says, I looked and behold, a green horse. Good on you, Mr. Tyndale. Because that's obviously accurate. It's authentic. So I've got no idea where pale came from. It's a green horse. And green is the colour of Islam, which is purely a passing curiosity. I'm not saying it proves anything, which wasn't even my point anyway, turning to Revelation 6. I just couldn't resist covering that in passing. The main point is looking at verse 8 of Revelation 6. It says that this green horse, has authority over one quarter of the earth to kill, right? Well, okay. If we're saying that perhaps the prophecies about the actions of this fourth terrible beast and so on are limited territorially and don't necessarily mean every last part of the planet, well, there's some interesting sort of corroboration here, because a quarter of the earth in verse 8, this green horse, perhaps referring to Islam in a coded way, has authority over one quarter of the earth. How do you measure a quarter of the earth? Well, there's 3 ways you can do that. One is you can measure the population. One is you can measure the number of nations out of the total. One is you can measure the land area, the territory. So if you do that for Islam, what do you find? Well, population-wise, Muslims represent about 1.67 billion out of about a total 7 billion, which comes to about 25%. So, amazingly, one-fourth of the Earth's population are Muslims, Islamic peoples. So when it says here the green horse has authority over one quarter of the earth, does it mean that refers to the Muslim population? What have you come to the nations on the earth? How many nations are Muslim or predominantly Muslim out of all the nations on the earth? Well, there are approximately 50 Muslim nations. That is to say 100% or very high percentages of Muslims, about 50, 51, out of approximately 200 sovereign nations on the earth. So that comes to about, strangely enough, 25%. What about land area, you know, if you like, physical territory occupied by Islamic nations out of the total on the earth? Well, if you exclude Antarctica, and there's only penguins down there, so it's probably fair enough. I don't think there's any Islamic penguins around. Then what you've got is that the main countries which are Islamic or predominantly Muslim countries, you've got 12.5 million square miles out of about 50 million square miles, which, guess what? That's about 25%. So by any measure, whether it's people, land, number of sovereign countries, one quarter are Muslim. So it certainly, to me, strongly hints that the pale horse, the green horse, has authority over the Muslim world. So that may indicate that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, we're talking of events that will largely dominate the Islamic realm, just as is what we appear to be seeing in the beasts of Daniel 7 and 8 and 9. And just before we leave, what colour are the four horses of Revelation 6? Well, the first horse, verse 2, a white horse. Verse 4, a fiery red horse. Verse 5, I looked and behold, a black horse. And verse 8, a green horse. So white, red, black, green. Isn't it interesting that all the Arab countries, their flags are made up only of these four colours? All Arab flags are made up of either or a sort of combination of white, red, black, and green. Some are only green. Some are all four colours, white, red, black, green. But no other colours appear, with one exception, I think, Qatar. But other than that one exception, every other flag of all the Arab nations, that's curious, isn't it? Now, if you go to other countries, you get blues and yellows, and obviously, you know, red and white and black are very popular. I'm not saying otherwise. It's just another of those very strange coincidences that all the flags of the Islamic Arab world only use the four colours of the horsemen of the apocalypse. How odd. Anyway, it means nothing. other than the fact that perhaps when Jesus opens the four seals, or the first four seals, maybe it's those opening of the seals that trigger the events of Daniel 7 and 8 and 9 and so on, because the seals start something going, don't they? Jesus opens a seal, a horse appears, and then things happen. So is that what triggers the beasts of Daniel 7 and 8 and so on, the seals being opened? Worth thinking about. Let's go back to Daniel 7, read verse 24. So that was just an aside, but it sort of doesn't do any harm to the belief that Islam is what we're talking about, although none of those probably are, you know, conclusive proofs in their own, but I think the hint is there. Daniel 7:24. So the angel's explaining to Daniel this terrible beast. It says the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall rise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. Notice, shall arise after the 10. Got that? He arises after the 10. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 of the kings, or the horns. The horns represent kings or represent kingdoms. So the traditional view, which we've all grown up with, you might remember if you ever did your homework, are allegedly 10 kings which shall arise, if you like, one at a time. There'll be one, and then there'll be passage of decades or centuries, another one, a few more decades or centuries, another one, right the way up to the 9th one, being Italy under Garibaldi, ending in Mussolini, 1945, and the 10th one yet to come. I'm not going to belabor that, because there's plenty of material you can look at if you want to revisit that, if you're a bit rusty as to what you believed all these decades. The second view, which I'm suggesting might be more natural just reading it, is that these 10 kings all arise at one time, simultaneously, and are yet to arise. And they are 10 kingdoms which unite to form this particular end time Islamic empire. And then after the 10 have come together, this pompous leader, this Islamic Antichrist, subdues 3. Says that? He shall subdue 3 kings. Well, in terms of the traditional Roman view, the correspondence course says that these 3 kings which were subdued were the Vandals, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, between 429 AD and 554 AD. And it says they were rooted up at the behest of the papacy, because the pompous horn is said to be the papacy, the Vatican. So the papacy apparently rooted up these 3 nations. I don't see how that happened. And then there's 7 more horns to come, of which 6 have now been and gone, and 1 more is left. That's basically what you and I believed for a few decades. However, if this is future prophecy, if this is the yet future end time Islamic empire, with 10 Islamic nations combining together under their superpower leader, their Mahdi, their savior, then all this is yet to happen. And 3 kings are yet to be subdued out of those 10 that at least temporarily unite. And if that's the case, well, actually, Daniel tells us who they are. Because we hold your place there, I think, and turn to Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43. So we haven't done Daniel 11 yet. I suppose one day we might get there, but cutting in and avoiding being distracted too much. At the time of the end, got it? At the time of the end, because lots of Daniel is really not about the ancient history. It's about the time of the end. You know, Daniel was told to seal up the words until the time of the end, to go his ways and rest in the grave, because these things were for many days in the future. So it's quite consistent. Anyway, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, being the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He, the king of the north, shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Right, now I'm going to suggest, since we're following at the moment the Islamic end time empire theory, that this is the Islamic Antichrist, who's sorting out some problems in the Islamic realm. He shall also enter the glorious land. Well, that's modern-day Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown by him. But these shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And that generally seems to point towards Jordan, around the Jordan area. So he doesn't, for whatever reasons, take them apart. We used to think, I wonder if that's because Petra's there. And maybe Jordan escapes the wrath of this king of the north because it's a way of keeping, you know, Petra accessible for God's people. Hint, hint. Well, maybe someday we'll get there. But the three kings who'd be subdued, who are they? So they've got these 10 Islamic kingdoms uniting together. There's been some disputes, and I'm afraid three of these are going to get subdued. Verse 42, he, the king of the north, the Islamic Antichrist, I'll use that shorthand, shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. It seems the Libyans and so-called Ethiopians are allies of Egypt, and all three of those Islamic nations fall to the king of the north and are subjugated by him. Now, it says Ethiopia, but it's not Ethiopia. The Hebrew is Cush. Cush and the Cushites, C-U-S-H, Cush. The Cushites actually are modern-day Sudan, not Ethiopia, Sudan. If you turn to Wikipedia, for example, it tells us that Sudan, as it's now called, was the ancient home of the kingdom of Cush. So the three Islamic nations who are subdued, brought to heel, so to speak, by the king of the north, the Islamic Antichrist, are Egypt and Libya and Sudan. All, of course, are strong Islamic countries. And they fall to him as essentially captives. It says, shall fall at his heels. Well, that can be either in association with you or as captives, and the context makes it pretty clear. Somehow they've got the nose of the Islamic Antichrist, and he's taught them a lesson. So who are the three kings subdued back in Daniel 7? Let's turn back there. It appears to be Sudan, Libya, and then Egypt. So back to Daniel 7. Let's read verses 25 through 27. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, and the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So we covered this before. To change times and laws, is that perhaps changing to an Islamic calendar? Which is what they use, based upon the life and adventures of Muhammad. Is it changing perhaps our well-known weekends, Saturday, Sunday, to be based around Friday? And in terms of changing law, well, you know, the objective of Islam is to ensure that Sharia law is followed worldwide, as it is in many Islamic countries today. And Sharia law is based on the teachings of Muhammad, and it affects economics, banking, society, family matters, sexual matters. It brings the teachings of Allah into every aspect of life. And that is definitely what the Islamic world wants to do. It wants to establish Sharia law everywhere. So I would think absolutely this pompous leader, if it's the Islamic Antichrist, that's absolutely on his agenda. Change times, change calendars, change to Sharia law. And it talks about the saints being under his thumb for 3.5 years. Time, times, and half a time. Now, the temptation, we've said before, is for some people to say, you know what, this is all Old Testament stuff. It was all fulfilled, if at all, in 70 AD when the Romans, brackets, but actually Syrians and Egyptians under Roman leadership, destroyed the temple and the sanctuary and the city. Well, that could be the case, other than the fact that, of course, we've got the book of Revelation, which comes after the sacking of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So let's turn to Revelation 13. I read verses 1 to 3. And the reason for spending a bit of time, both last time and the time before in Daniel 7 and their beasts, is because really we have to understand the beasts of Daniel to have any chance of making any sense of Revelation, because Revelation really draws on a huge amount of Daniel, especially obvious in Daniel, sort of, Revelation 13. So if you dive into Revelation 13, just think, I'll just read it from scratch and understand it. You no chance. Revelation 13, received by John, island of Patmos, somewhere around about 90-odd AD or thereabouts. So, yeah, certainly well after the fall of Jerusalem, and so therefore yet future. And I'd suggest that this Revelation 13 beast, well, you get two options. Traditional view is it describes the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Empire between the year dot or thereabouts for centuries up to today. The alternative view is it applies to the near future and an Islamic empire. So, verse 1. I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast I saw was like a leopard, his feet like feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marvelled and followed the beast. So it's got, you can almost hopefully recognise Daniel 7 tucked in here. The beast has seven heads. Well, okay, one for the lion, one for the bear, four for the leopard, one for the great and terrible beast, that's seven heads. The Daniel 7 beast had ten horns, and here's the ten horns. So this is the composite beast. This beast is a composite of Daniel 7. And notice it says here, verse 2, the dragon gave this beast, this empire, his authority, his power. Who's the dragon? Well, of course, that's Satan. And who's Allah, by the way? Well, it's Satan. Allah is not the God you and I worship. You know, George Bush Jr. might say that we all worship the same God, and we don't. Allah is not the God of the Bible. Allah is no other than Satan. Simple as that. 1.67 billion people worship Satan, calling him Allah, and that's the end of it. So if Allah gives us power and authority and influence to the Islamic realm, well, that's just the dragon by another name. Now, our traditional view, of course, is that we're talking here about the Roman Empire through many centuries. The deadly wound, I'm sure you remember from your studies of the past, was when Rome fell in 476 AD. I'm sure you remember that. Do you? Well, actually, of course, to be accurate, Roman Empire didn't fall to 1453 AD, when the, interestingly enough, Muslims conquered Constantinople, which was the eastern part, and actually, for centuries, the ruling portion of the Roman Empire. And if that's the case, and it's Rome and the Roman Empire through its risings and fallings, century after century after century, as of horn came after horn came after horn, then to a large extent, much of this is not relevant to you now because it's historic. You know, it relates to the 400s AD, the 600s AD, 1000 AD. It's of little practical relevance to you and me. The alternative is that actually this is yet future. This is the Islamic Empire of 10 nations combining together in the near future. It's the Islamic Empire as it hits its final end time peak just before Jesus returns, in which case it's extremely relevant what's in here, every verse of it. And as for the deadly wound that was healed, that's quite likely to be as recent as 1922 to 1924. Because that's when the Ottoman Empire, the final Islamic empire, was shut down in 1922, just a little after the First World War. And the official Islamic Caliphate was disbanded in 1924. As to what the Caliphate is, it's an Islamic term. The Caliphate doesn't exist today, although ISIS claim they're it, but an exaggeration. The Caliphate, C-A-L-I-P-H-A-T-E, the Caliphate, is the generic Islamic empire ruled by a caliph. A caliph is a successor to Muhammad, to whom all Muslims in any part of the world must give their allegiance to the caliph over the caliphate. The caliph's authority is beyond dispute. He is the political leader. He is the spiritual leader of all Muslims everywhere. Doesn't exist today because it suffered a deadly wound between 1922 and 1924. But it is to return somewhere just ahead of us. Verse 4 of Revelation 13. So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. If you worship Allah, that's what you're doing, folks. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast who is able to make war with them? Well, actually, quite a few of the Islamic countries, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, are stuffed full of missiles, tanks, submarines, and, of course, potentially, at some point, nuclear weapons. Verse 5, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Well, historically, the traditional view is that's 1,260 years, you know, 42 months, each month, you know, being sort of 30 days, 1,260 years, allegedly, runs from, I think, 554 AD up to 1814, the fall of Napoleon. That's what's being referred to in these 42 months, if you go with the traditional view. I've got to say, I find that pretty unconvincing. The alternative view is that we're talking here of 42 months, 3.5 years. Which you'll recognize is a time period that pumps up quite a lot. 7-year covenant, abomination of desolation halfway through it, leaves 3.5 years to come. Jesus says when the abomination is set up, there will be great tribulation such as never been on the earth before. That's 3.5 years worth of tribulation. So I reckon this is talking of 42 months, literally, yet to come, during which time it's going to be pretty rough. If you're in the territory where Islamic rule applies and are a believer in Christ. Carrying on, it was granted to him, verse 7, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, Allah, and his empire, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. Now, all the earth, all who dwell on the earth. Okay, we got a bit of ambiguity there. Is that again referring to the Islamic realm, where the Islamic empire has power and authority, or does it mean the whole globe? We've covered that already, so it's a little bit unclear. Verse 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. You know, maybe saying that if you're a a saint who's being harassed, who's being persecuted, who's being put to death, so be it. But he who puts you to death will himself die with a sword. And that's just something, as a saint, you'll have to be patient about and keep your faith going. Okay, so that's that first beast of Revelation 13. It appears to be the end time, final Islamic empire, possibly the caliphate, but it will have a powerful leader, the Islamic Antichrist, the pompous horn, which brings us, I think, into the second beast in Revelation 13, beginning in verses 11 through 18. Let's just read those and we go back and unpack it a little bit. Verse 11, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth," question mark, how far the earth extends, "but causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image or likeness to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image or likeness of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here's the solution, here's wisdom, here's the answer. Let him who's understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. His number is 666. And that, of course, makes it plain and clear. If only. So let's go back and have a look at this in more detail. So the first beast of Revelation 13, I'm suggesting, is more likely to be the Islamic end time empire or caliphate. The option is to say it's the Roman Empire of the last 1500 years or something. That's the options. Verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon. Well, obviously this is Satan behind this, the dragon. Well, traditionally, the two horns we think are, well, horns signify sort of power, authority, leadership, often a kingdom. And the two horns, we would have said historically, are the papacy, the Vatican, which has religious rule, through the Catholic Church, but also has some sort of state rule because, Vatican City is a separate sovereign country. And it has ambassadors in many countries from Vatican City. So the view was the two horns picture, if you like, religious rule and sort of state, political sort of rule. Well, that's okay, fine. If it's Islamic, if this is an Islamic beast, the Islamic Antichrist, the ruler of the first beast, perhaps the Caliph, the Mahdi, then of course he has two horns because he is the spiritual religious leader. He is the political leader. And unlike the Pope, the caliphs do carry power and authority. And when they tell the Islamic realm to do something, it gets done. So this entirely fits an Islamic idea. So two horns, spiritual and political leadership of the Pope, or the Islamic Antichrist supreme leader. He exercises all the authority of the first beast, gets him to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Well, does that worship Rome? worship the Roman Empire? Okay. Or is it worship the Islamic Empire, which has returned now in its power and glory following the deadly wound of 1922-24? He performs great signs, which are certainly interesting. How real are these signs? How genuine are they? But apparently they're genuine enough to impress people, lots of people, that this man is the man of God or the man of Allah, right? And he says in verse 14 that other nations, other peoples, should make an image to the beast who lives, or make a likeness, which is an alternative translation. So make an image, the Greek word is icon, E-I-K-O-N, make an icon, which can be a likeness. Well, actually, the final Islamic ruler is certainly going to tell nations to make a copy of Islam. He's going to force all countries, absolutely, to install Sharia law and model their societies on pain of death on the Islamic principles, on Islamic law, on Sharia law, on worship of Allah and his messenger. So to make a likeness of the Islamic empire, Islamic society, yeah, it's easy to understand that one, I think, with the Islamic model. Dropping down, verse 15, it says, if you don't worship Islam, it says, verse 15, you will be killed. If you don't worship the image of the beast, potentially this could be a physical image, I suppose, but it does say it would speak. A bit hard quite to see that being literally true, that an image would speak, but I'll leave that open. But it's certainly not hard to read these verses as saying, when this guy gets in charge and he's got the massive power of hundreds of millions of Muslims prepared to die for their faith, prepared to make others die for their faith, that when he says, you better shape up and you better organize your country according to Islam and Sharia law, and if you don't do that, you're for the high jump, I can see that being really extremely plausible. Notice verse 16. He causes all to receive a mark, the mark of the beast, on their right hand or on their foreheads. And you can't buy or sell unless you've got the mark or the name or the number. Now, is the Islamic Antichrist, this second beast individual, is this implying that the buying and selling, the putting to death, applies only within the territory envisaged by the prophecy, in other words, a quarter of the earth? Or is it, global? That's, again, not totally clear. I have to leave that, I think, open for the moment. It certainly would apply within the territory of the Islamic realm, has to do. Beyond that, question mark. And it's three things, three options if you want to buy and sell. It'd be pretty tricky not to be able to buy and sell. Well, you can't have a job, perhaps. You can't buy a house. You can't buy food. You can't buy a drink. You can't buy, gasoline or petrol. You can't heat your home. Because if you can't buy and sell, you are really in a serious place. And there's three things you have to do to be able to buy and sell. One is receive the mark of the beast. Or, and that's not all, you may not receive the mark, or you must have the beast's name, or the number of the beast. There's three things, three options. Now, the traditional oblique popular views are that, if you come from the worldwide Church of God background, and probably if it's Seventh-day Adventist background, the mark of the beast has to do with Sunday worship. The Roman Catholic Church is going to eradicate anything other than Sunday worship. You'll have to go to Mass. You'll have to stop working on Sundays. And if you try to keep Sabbaths holy, they'll come in and get you. So the mark of the beast is enforced Sunday observance. Plausible. Well, there's a bit of scope there. If the Roman European model and Catholic model is the right one, but okay, not entirely convinced by that one. A very popular view today among Bible believers generally is that the mark of the beast is an electronic chip, which will be implanted into your hand or your forehead. It will contain your ID and your approval by the beast empire, so that you're empowered by presenting your forehead to be read by a scanner, or your hand. It will recognize that, yep, you're okay, and you can trade and buy and sell, have a job and all the rest of it. But if you're not approved, your chip will be either not there or it'll be, you know, turned off, and you'll be once again in serious trouble. And it's a very popular idea, because technology today probably means that if somebody wanted to do that, they could certainly do it for perhaps much of the earth. But if the Islamic Empire is actually the end-time beast empire of Revelation 13, is there something else that could be referred to by the mark of the Islamic Empire, or the name of the Islamic Empire, or the number of the Islamic Empire? Because it's not just a mark in your hand. It could be simply the name. It could be simply having the number. Is there a solution that makes some sense if you're looking for an Islamic empire to be the end-time fulfillment of these prophecies? The answer is a yes, but we'll have to wait until next week, I'm afraid, to cover that. But it's key not to take this mark. It's very, very serious in God's eyes, because let's look finally at Revelation 14, verses 9 to 12 as we close. It's not a light thing. You might think, well, surely God would allow me to, you know, buy and sell. I've got a family to feed and you know, a house to warm and a car to drive. God understands that, surely, which he does, of course. But there's something intrinsic in taking the beast's name or the beast's number or the mark, either any of the three. Revelation 14 talks about some bad things going to happen to these people. Verse 9, the third angel followed, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. I mean, do you want God's wrath undiluted? Does anybody? It continues, and he, this individual that worships the beast or takes his mark, he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of all of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb at Jesus' return, in other words, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints, because they don't do any of these things. The saints are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. You've got an option. Keep the commandments of God, the faith of Jesus, or if you accept worship of the beast and his mark, you will face the undiluted wrath of Almighty God and be tormented day and night. That's not a great place to be. Would God do that just because you were forced to have a chip in your hand so you could have a job and feed your family? Well, there's something more in this story, but let's leave that for another time. So if you want to hear the story or this particular version of it, come back same time next week. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.